Hello everybody and welcome to the Wild Ginger Running YouTube channel live broadcast. Today we are talking to author and athletics coach Steve Chilton, whose latest book is Voices from the Fells, from the Hills, I should say, Pioneering Women at Fell and Mountain Runners. So welcome Steve, how are you doing today? I believe you have just moved house.
Yep, I'm fine. I'm in a room that's not got a lot of boxes in, but there's other rooms that have got a lot of boxes unpacked. So we just moved to the edge of the South Downs, which is a change from London, I can tell you that.
Oh, that sounds lovely. The edge of the South Downs. Brilliant. Oh, well, congratulations on the move. And it's good that you've got your bookshelf behind you. That's very appropriate.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm in my little den, my study area.
Lovely. So this is where the magic happens then, because you've written many other books. Before we go on, I'll just mention that you've written so many other books about fell running as well, which are really, really fascinating. So there's including It's a Hill, Get Over It, which is about fell running's history and characters. So that's a kind of a general overview, which you started with. Then there's The Round, about the Bob Graham and Bob Graham himself as well. So that's a round in the Lake District that's quite famous in fell running circles. And then Running Hard, which is a rivalry of some top fell runners, John Wild and Kenny Stewart, which is a really fascinating read. And then one of my favourites is All or Nothing at All, which is the history of legendary Lake District fell runner Billy Bland, who many people will know held that Bob Graham record for 39 years until Killian Jornet came over and broke it. And then Jack Quenzel came over and broke it. Fascinating books, but yeah, a lot about the blokes. Hey, so your latest book is a hugely important work in my view, and an absolutely fantastic history of women's fell and mountain running that just needed to be written. It was crying out for it with so many amazing achievements just lately from women. It's just great to know about the history of how it all started. So Steve, what was your inspiration for writing this book first of all?
Well, it's kind of interesting. There was no one point where I thought, right, I need to write that. I was been writing and researching the other stuff, and I obviously was aware and wrote about some of the performances by Jasmine Paris, by Nikki Spinks, and people who were doing amazing things. And then it kind of occurred to me over a sort of period of time that actually it wasn't about what the people were doing now, which are fantastic, but it was actually what people weren't allowed to do. And I started thinking about, I'm writing about this race, there's no women. I'm writing about this event, there's no women. And there was this whole thing about the 3A's, the Athletics Association laws, not allowing women to compete. So I thought, well, someone should write that because it's in parallel with marathon running, where women couldn't run marathons up to a certain age, year, and they couldn't run in the Olympics over 1500 meters. Until really late on. So it was in parallel with that. But I thought originally it probably shouldn't be me that wrote the book. I mulled over that, talked to a couple of friends, and I was convinced by Rebecca Robinson, who's a friend of mine who's an international athlete, that I actually should take it on board. And interestingly enough, I was interviewing people in the book later on, and Ruth Pickvance, one of the people I interviewed, said, actually, myself, Ruth, and Helen Diamantidis, or Whittaker as she is now, thought about writing something on that very topic, but never got round to it. And she said, it's absolutely brilliant that I've spent the time to research and write it. So that was already a nice sort of feeling that it was well received by someone who was out there at the time.
Yeah, because, if someone's not written it, it's okay for anybody to be the spokesperson and the compilation of all those women's voices. It's okay for you to be a man writing the story because you're not altering it, you're just writing what they've told you. So I just think it's fantastic. The book needed writing, and it's great that men are also championing women's history. So I think it's fantastic, and I think it's really, really great of you to do it.
I think one of the strengths is that although it's written by me, it's what the reason it's called Voices from the Hills. Mm. It's in the voices and the stories and the incidents that people are related to me, that the strength of the situation and the barriers, everything comes through from those voices. And I think that's one of the really strong points about the book, to be honest.
Yeah, definitely. And it sort of, it goes chronologically, and you cover a few key women from that period, and it's their voices. It's like a transcript of the interview, basically, that goes in there, isn't it? And the illustrations, obviously, they're your wife, aren't they? The beautiful illustrations of the hills throughout. I'll see if I can just hold one up here. There we are.
Yeah, that's Maura's work, my wife, and she's just on pen and ink drawings of what I think are the three most notable and prominent skylines in the three countries of England, Scotland and Wales. And they just break up the chapters with the change from narrative to interview.
Yeah, it is a beautiful addition to the book as well. And I'm... there are so many voices in here, and obviously there's some people that I've heard of, like Pauline Stewart and Roz Coates and Jean Dawes, which I'm sure we'll come on to in a minute. But how, there's so many that I also hadn't heard of. How did you find out about all these amazing women to put into this book?
Well, it's interesting. Rebecca Robinson gave me some hints of some people to approach. The stuff that you'd written on a blog somewhere about some of the people, made sure I went and covered it. But the really interesting thing was that there was a kind of a domino effect of the network. So I might approach one person and got contact details of them. Or have you got, are you speaking to so-and-so? They were prominent at the same time. I'll get their address for you and get their approval for you to approach them. So there's this really nice sort of ripple going through where people... and what was interesting again was people said, I've so enjoyed going back through my own records and reliving some of those moments. And it was kind of a cathartic thing for some of the people who've been running in the 70s and may not be running now, maybe slightly distanced from the sport, but we were reliving those moments and had some fantastic... anecdotes and stories about things in there. So yeah, that was how it came together, really.
Yeah, it is fantastic, and it must have been really interesting as well. Just, I find it really interesting, like being a journalist and talking to all these different people about their different things. But this must have been like even more interesting because there's just so many people and so many people involved, and that snowball effect as well.
Well, it was. So I've said it before in sort of talks and interviews that I actually really like the research process and the talking to people and the investigating and getting the linkages. I find the writing quite hard.
Oh, really?
But what was interesting was all this was happening in COVID times. So I was very rarely able to do face-to-face interviews. So there were Zoom interviews, there were email exchanges. And to me, I lost a little bit. I don't feel I know some of the people from this book as well as I would have done in the other books because I've never met them. And that's a kind of a disappointment, but it was circumstances. And we've got around it by technology and everything else. But there was a fantastic process of meeting people. And meeting Sarah Rowell, the London marathoner who set the UK record once and is now high profile in the sport. Of mountain running. It was a fantastic experience, it's just another meeting of minds that I've so enjoyed.
Yeah, it's really cool, and there are so many, like compared to the other books where there maybe was like a focus on one person and their family, and or maybe a rivalry between two, there is like literally like 100 people in the book. Like, it would have taken you a long time, wouldn't it, to travel to each person, to arrange a time when you're both free. It would have cost a lot more money to do all that, so maybe it's a good thing that Zoom is available and COVID just facilitated more of the technological side of things.
Well, I certainly did less traveling to go and talk to people. I mean, there were occasions on other books where I've driven from London, where I was living, to the Lakes or the Midlands or Yorkshire to do one interview, and that wasn't necessary, and that was a slight plus. But I do like the face-to-face.
Yeah, and when you do, like, I'm just thinking for your next book, if you do a load of interviews with people, do you ever video them? Because that could be like an extra sort of added bonus to the book that people could go online and they could, see the interviews be a little bit extra.
Actually, I did some Zoom interviews, and at the time when I started, I didn't realise there was an automatic recording setting you could make for Zoom conversations. Yeah. And of course, when that happened, I thought, well, I've actually got these interviews now. But they weren't done in the way that you would use them, in the way you're doing a podcast, where it's clear what you're doing and it's for public consumption. It's not easy to say to someone, well, actually, I'd like to, a conversation. You need to have agreed it in advance, shall we say.
Yeah, it is a bit of a different ball game, isn't it? And it would maybe not make them open up as well. If there was a camera there, it just adds that other dimension, doesn't it? And it's like less private, and you might not get the best from some people necessarily.
I mean, in an ideal world, there's so much oral history that is recorded in all the interviews I've done over the books. I thought, well, maybe that should be archived somewhere. But the problem is what people have said. You never know when someone's going to say something that is not
that they don't necessarily want
not
in
appropriately.
Public. Yeah.
Because it might be a personal comment about something.
Yeah.
So you could have done it if you'd known in advance you were doing a series of archival interviews, but I wasn't. I was interviewing people for research purposes.
Yeah. And I wonder as well, with the amount of wonderful information you've compiled in the book, I wonder if anybody is interested in doing some Wikipedia entries for all these amazing women, because I know that that's a thing at the moment, is putting female scientists, especially on Wikipedia, because history sort of writes them out, female medics, female scientists. So it'd just be interesting if anybody wanted to take up that job and whether you'd agree to.
There's a fellow researcher that I've made contact with, that I've never met, called Katie Holmes, who's got a handle, Run Young 50, I think it is, and she's researching particularly female athletes of that era. And she's written, she went on a training course to do how properly to do referencing in Wikipedia entries, and she certainly added a few in. I would like to think I might have time to do the same at one point or other, but it's very time consuming to do well.
So
what I normally do is just put in make sure there's a reference to my book, if there is already a Wikipedia page for people, which is a kind of a selfish, self-sufficing thing. That
it kills two birds with one stone, doesn't it?
Absolutely, yeah.
Find out more here, and 1p to Steve. That's excellent. Well, so reading your book, I've been reading it off and on at bedtimes, and that was the wrong time to read it, because as a woman myself, I really like the book, obviously, but it did make me kind of freshly angry at the sheer injustice of it all. So I know many people listening now will be familiar with Catherine Switzer in the 1967 Boston Marathon, that quite frankly terrifying set of photos showing that race director just trying to rugby tackle her out of the race effectively. She got hate mail, and that was 1967. It still took them till 1972, 5 years later, to let women into the race officially. And that's only 56 years ago. That's in some of our lifetimes. That's in your lifetime. That's in my parents' lifetimes, definitely my grandparents' lifetimes and all of our grandparents' lifetimes. And it's just baffling that it was so recently, and in the foul running world, even more recently, that they officially accepted women. So you've got Kathleen Connachy, is it?
Connachy.
Yeah. Kathleen Connachy. So she ran the Ben Nevis race in 1955, and there were a fair few others that you've detailed in the book that are sneaking into the men's races, like half a mile down the road and stuff like that. But it wasn't until 1977 that foul running officially allowed women in. And then for the Ben Nevis race, not even till 1980. I was born in 1983. And it's just unbelievable. But it was a genuinely held European, US medical belief, wasn't it, that women shouldn't run because their wombs might fall out.
It's an amazing thought that is considered to be, scientific, medical things to go by. But, I mean, it even goes back to what I quote in the book somewhere, what Baron de Coubertin said about the women competing. And I've got it in front of me now. This is the end of the 1800s. I can't remember exactly what year it was when the Olympics were starting. He said, allowing women in sports would harm their feminine charm and degrade the sport in which they participated. Now, that was obviously a long time ago. But the problem is that in the 70s, the women's 3As had the same attitude. You know, the people who were in charge were not prepared to argue for change. So, you know, the system was actually against change. And people had to work really hard to change that. That's why there was a lot of unofficial running in races in the early 70s before the 3A's laws changed, because people were just so incensed. And there's, you know, loads of stories about that.
Yeah, and they actually believed that sport would make girls masculine. It would make them sterile, perhaps, like their uteruses would fall out. And there was also, you wrote in the book, some people believed there was a finite amount of energy that women had. Yeah. And if they used that up on sport, they might not be able to conceive and give birth, which is basically our role on the planet, isn't it, here?
Yeah.
It was from fear, wasn't it? It was from a place of fear and a place of protection, as well as, you know, keeping women in their place.
Yeah, absolutely. And people were saying, the radical people were saying, well, if we're not allowed to do it, if it's not safe for us, it's not safe for anyone. Sometimes they were arguing that the women shouldn't go on the hill because it wasn't safe and they were a liability and it wasn't for them. Well, that's, you know, women and men are no different in the sense of their ability to survive or get lost or you know, do anything. It's exactly the same, you know, as long as they've got the training and the experience, they can do it. So that was another dead end that was put out to stop doing it.
And I suppose tied in with that is the thought that it's a horrible thought that, like, it's the reason women aren't allowed on the front line still, and it's the reason that men are physically stronger and perhaps, in a horrible way, more expendable, because you've got the women looking after the children and giving birth to the children. You only need one man to, you know, sire several women and breed, whereas women, you can only really do one thing at a time, can't you? So
absolutely,
there's that sort of side to it too, which is a bit sexist.
But the performances more recently by Jasmine and Nikki and other people have proved that the physical side of things is definitely a non-argument. You know, it's particularly as things get longer. There's no real reason why people can't do anything at all.
Well, I think the physical argument is still a biological truth. The men are physically stronger than women. But when you get to those longer races and you get all the additional things that you have to consider, like the navigation, the nutrition, looking after yourself, the strategy, the sleep, the pacing, and all those other things as well as just pure muscle, that's where the playing field just gets evened out, in my view. Yeah. So, yes, I do think there is a truth in the fact that we are physically different, men and women, and let's not shy away from that, because it's not sexist at all to say that. But you will get some women who are stronger than some men, but overall the best men will be faster over shorter distances than the best women, but not necessarily the long ones, which is very exciting for the world of ultra running and trail running.
I don't know if you remember the bit in the book, but when I was talking to Sarah Ryle, she had an interesting perspective. She didn't measure herself on what position she got or what time she got. She measured herself against the men in the race. And she had this formula saying, what percentage of the winning time am I? And is it a good percentage? And that was her métier. It was like, okay, there's something I can measure myself against. I may or may not beat all women. That's neither here nor there. But how close I am to the men. And that was how she looked at it. And that was her perspective on it.
I do remember.
That isn't the standard way of looking at it, but that was the way she looked at it.
Yeah, no, I think that is a thing as well, because I'm sure Lizzie Hawker said to me once, after she won the UTMB, she would race and she'd be ahead of all the women, and then she'd just start picking off the men. And she came in the top 10 one year. I think it was 2012 that she came in the top 10. And that was really amazing. And that was a shortened course. So she was upset because she felt like she could have knocked off a few more men if she'd had a bit longer. I thought it's also interesting in your book. This wasn't a global belief, was it, that women couldn't run and shouldn't run? There were some places where it was perfectly acceptable for women to run, and I thought that was interesting, like, for example, the Mexican Tarahumara Indians and some other
populations. Yeah, the tribe that Chris McDougall, I think, wrote his book about, was the case, and there are other cultures where being a messenger was acceptable and normal and It wasn't global, but in the sort of the Western world, it was. But there are also other examples of sports that were much more progressive. So I mentioned the fact that orienteering, when it became organised, immediately had exactly equal opportunities in competition for men and women. You know,
and
why?
When was that?
Just a different mindset was in place by the people organising.
Was that before the 70s then that orienteering became like that?
In the late 60s, I think the British Orienteering Federation was set up, which I think was a couple of years before the Fell Runners Association.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
and you remember the story that I relayed from Brenda Robinson about the first meeting of the Fell Runners Association, who were then tasked with organising and formalising the sport in 1970. A bunch of men were in the meeting. She was the wife of one of the guys on the committee and had to wait outside in the car while they had their meeting. In fact, it was worse than that. She was actually locked out and was playing with a young child in really cold weather outside. You know, that's just an appalling mindset to have about roles and perspectives, isn't it, really?
Yeah, it's like a boys' club, isn't it? I think the UK has quite a history of boys' clubs, doesn't it? So, yeah.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. But,
and so during your research from the book, was there any sort of one story that maybe shocked you the most or was like the most extreme when you were researching about the history of women's running?
Not really one particular story, but there was a sequence of events where race organisers would then allow a race to take place, but it was immediately a different and shorter course, or they would say to the ladies, you have to start just before, a minute or 2 minutes before, or just after. Both of those options at the end cause problems. If you're starting before, you're in danger of a whole bunch of guys coming past you and all sorts of things going wrong there. If you're a good runner and you're asked to go from right from the back, it frustrates you at that level because you want to be racing in the right place in the field. So I think that attitude, which was quite prevalent, is one of the things that most shocked me. Some of the prizes is also very illuminating.
Oh,
and people are arguing, you know, why give feminine prizes of very low value against the value of the men's prizes? And that was the start of the equality of the reward argument that still not resolved in all sports, is it?
Still not resolved. And Sophie Power has done a lot to promote this with She Races, which is really brilliant. And I just, in Jasmine Paris, legendary foul runner, she wrote your foreword and she said, even in 2014, she ran the Wasdale race and there wasn't a prize for the first lady. That's like a few years ago.
Yeah,
I was
going to
say
ago,
that's
yeah.
3 years ago. It's a lot longer than that now. But yeah, that's bonkers. And there was a prize, she remembers there was a prize for the first two men and a Vet 40 prize for the men or something, but there was no prize for the ladies. And it just seems bananas now that was still going on and that was still accepted. And she came, what was it like? She came on the podium, didn't she, in that race? I can't remember. I'll look whilst you talk. But yeah, that's the kind of thing that Sophie Power is looking at. Yeah, here we are. She finished third overall and first lady in the Wasdale Fell race, narrowly beaten to second place in a sprint off Lingmel. I was surprised at the prize giving when the first two men both received a trophy, one being for a veteran over 40, but one didn't exist for the ladies at all. She joked about needing to run faster next year to finish in the top two. Nevertheless, I was pleased to see a female trophy appear for the next edition of the race. Yes, I really thought they should have like made one appear posthumously for the 2014 race. That's absolutely barmy.
Yeah.
That's only 9 years ago.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, I'd be fuming. And so clearly women wanted to race. There's tons of women in the book that wanted to race. Did you find from all your interviewing that there was any single overarching reason as to why these women did want to race?
Not really. It was just several of them just said, I just wanted to go out onto the hills, and that led to the thought, well, why can't I compete as well? So some of the things like the Felsman and some of the endurance events were actually allowing women to do it because it was just, you know, accepted that they would be able to do that. So yes, it was it was just a feeling that, you know, why can't I do that? You know, it's also a bit of a social thing where free time was becoming available, and, you know, sharing of parental duties was more likely to happen. So the opportunities was there. And I mean, there's a story, I can't remember which I think it was Jackie Hargreaves, I can't remember which interview it was, of someone taking the kids to school and then going home and getting changed because they didn't feel they could turn up at the school in their running kit.
You know, their running kit,
even then in sort of that society, it was considered to be wrong.
And that's balmy, isn't it? Because I literally, I've been out this morning doing hill reps with Finley in the buggy up and down the road. And, you know, the like workmen are like, yay, well done. And, like, you know, big burly blokes are like, yay, well done, oh, isn't he cute? And, you know, I run down to nursery with Finley on his bike and he runs fast. He cycles faster than I can run. So I'm like, ah, makes me run faster. And, yeah, I'm always in my running gear with Finley.
Oh, absolutely.
Good way to fit it in. Seems sensible.
Yeah, it was just, I think it was just a realisation that on an individual level, you know, people... Joan Glass in Wales didn't seem to know that the scene was there, and her husband took her along to a race. And they still didn't realise there was a national scene of opportunities there. Things like the Youth Hostels Association were organising events for people. So there were. It was almost as if there was a disconnect, and that's why there had to be an organisation in the end that brought things together. There was a kind of disconnected scene that was different in different parts of the country. So it depended where you were, who you know, and how determined and ambitious you were to get out and do those things.
Yeah, because there wasn't obviously social media and the internet back then, so it would just be word of mouth and going to an event and seeing people there. And, you know, if you go to an event, watch your husband there and there's no other women there, it does take quite a strong person with a bit of a, you know, thick skin or maybe don't care a bit attitude about what you look like and stuff, if that's the pressures on women back then. And even now,
you could argue that it was a surprise that it took so long to happen. You know, if you take the Ben Nevis race, which I can't remember when it started. It started in 1895 or something.
Yeah.
And Joan Glass originally just made an application in 1975, and it was turned down. So why had it taken that long for somebody to try and breach that sort of barrier? And she did. She argued. She argued that there was actually a course record because they'd let Kanocchi do it before.
Yes.
So you can't say women can't run because you've already allowed it once.
Yes.
She was then allowed to run. And then, as she said, I was permitted to run, but I had to start 1 minute after the men. You know. And then that was 1975. It wasn't until 5 years later that the race formally allowed women to run. And deep irony, it was the year that it was cancelled because of the weather.
Oh no, that is ironic. Because women were sneaking into the races, weren't they? And you talk about they were doing things like going to registration with their hoods pulled up and signing up to races with just an initial rather than their full name so that they couldn't be found out. Yeah, and people like, who was it here? Jean Lochhead, she was threatened with a ban after jumping into a men's race about a quarter of a mile down the road.
Yeah.
And she went on to win the first Three Peaks race for women in 1979. So these are good runners. These are, you know, it seems really disrespectful that they had to hide in a bush and jump out.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, Schweitzer, the marathon runner, said that she didn't enter in initials to try and fool anyone. It was just that she liked Salinger's books and liked having someone like J.D. Salinger. She just thought two initials and name was a cool thing to have. So it wasn't a subterfuge at all. But there were people who did do that. But equally, there were people from the professional era, men, who entered amateur races under pseudonyms because of the schism that was there between the professional and the amateur scene in those early days. And so there's a whole backstory which I've written elsewhere of not being allowed to do things.
Yeah, it does seem very complicated, doesn't it? Just let everyone get on with it and let's go.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
But as I read through the book, especially in the earlier interviews with these pioneer women, as you've termed them here, it strikes me that many of the women that you interviewed, they didn't particularly see themselves as trailblazers at that time. Like maybe they can look back and go, well, yeah, that was pretty trailblazing what we did. But they also don't seem to identify or even want to be called particularly feminist. They just wanted to run in the hills. Yeah, I found that quite interesting because like I'm quite like stridently women's rights and I feel like that's an acceptable position to hold these days. Whereas back then that wasn't very... You know, there was so much that was wrong with the world. I would have thought they would be banging down the doors, but they were just like putting up with so much stuff and then just sneaking into a race. And that's all they don't think they were trailblazers.
There is a kind of a subplot in that, as you say, quite a lot of the early ones just wanted to go and do it and weren't particularly worried about how long it took them or whether they won or not. And there was a story about one race where you could see the whole of the course from the field that they started and finished from, and basically the women all ran together and were slightly embarrassed when they were told about, you know, not trying hard enough afterwards. But it took someone like Ros Coates or Pauline Stewart to come along, who had the drive immediately to be competitive for, and they kind of were the catalyst for the upgrading of the competition level generally across the events. I think that's fair comment to say about those particular two people. But there was a lovely story about Pauline Stewart overhearing someone saying that she wasn't good enough before the race and then proved that she was on the day and beat the person who said it. It was a male coach.
Excellent. Oh, that's brilliant. And so there was Ros and Pauline. Were there any other women who were actually pushing for change, like who saw this as an uneven, unfair playing field and were really going for it in terms of women's rights at this time?
Well, Veronique Moreau was one who was, again, who was come from the marathon sort of side, and she turned up to run at Ennerdale and had a massive argument with the race organiser who said he wasn't insured for her to run.
For wombs.
He proceeded to run anyway. You know, yeah. there were people like that who were making really strong statements.
Yeah, quite ballsy, yeah.
And visibly doing so. Or, she's one classic example of that, who's another one who was doing it.
Yeah. And what about the men? Were there any men who were like, yeah, this is ridiculous, this situation. What is going on? Or were the men all kind of like, right, close ranks, clamp down, no.
Well, again, there was a sort of a spectrum of complete no-no to, you know, go on then. Without naming names, there were certainly some that were allowing people to run unofficially before the laws had changed because they felt that was right. You get comments. I've got a piece here that's there was a report in the Faro in 1975. At least two race organisers were approached around this time with a view to inaugurating a ladies' race within their event. Both replied to the effect that a woman's place is in the home, not running up and down the fells. And that's two people who were race organisers in 1975 who could have initiated change.
1975. It's just like that's just not very long ago, is it? It's like 50 years ago. Yeah, just makes you have a big sigh, doesn't it? And so, have you got any particular favourite stories that you've included in the book?
Well, let's see. Yeah. I mean, what I was interested, not particular individual stories, but there was quite a theme of people coming into it from orienteering in the first instance and wanting to use running on the fells as fitness training.
Training, yeah. So
that was quite an interesting strand. And there were people who crossed over from cross country and rode and just wanted the variety. So the stories about those people, it was some interesting. What I think is more so than the what people were like at the beginning is what people have carried on to do and put things back into the sport. So the fact that Sarah Rowell is on the committee for the World Mountain Racing Association, is out in Austria now, at the World Mountain and Trail Champs. And she's an advocate of further change. So she's arguing with Go about the Olympic possibilities for mountain running.
Brilliant.
And apparently her response the other day to me was that more likely it's cross-country will come back into the Olympics than mountain. So it's things like that. Ruth Pickvance, for instance, was an international standard runner and a very brilliant fell runner. And she now runs a company called Element Active, which encourages women to get out and do activities. And her pitch is that confidence is one of the issues that people often face. So they won't do something until someone's shown them that they can do it.
Yeah.
So she runs weekend courses and just does that sort of thing, as does... is it Girls on? There's one in Scotland.
Girls on Hills.
Girlsonhills.com.
Yes,
Kerry Wallace,
who's
an exceptionally good athlete as well, an ultra runner. And again, she's just all about getting people out and experiencing stuff. And that might or might not lead to other things. You know, it's a bit like the outdoor equivalent of couch to 5K. You know, just have a go, see where you go when you get to the end of it. And I think it's just brilliant that people who come through the sport have their fantastic time. And then are prepared to spend the time to encourage others. And there's quite a lot of really good stories about other people encouraging others within the sport, within the club system, to have a go as well. And that was kind of part of the ripple effect that changed. Like Clayton Lemoore's Harriers suddenly had people coming along, and they became a driving force for opening up relays. You know, off-road relays to women to run in and things like that. So that's very much the things that I admire for people having the energy to do.
It's
timely.
And putting things back into the sport. Yeah. I'll have to have a look at Ruth's Element Active. I know Kerry and Girls on Hills. Nikki Spinks does some work with her as well, doesn't she?
Yes, he does. Yeah. But you should have a look at Ruth Pickvance's one, because it's a very good thing to point people to. And that's in Wales based, whereas Kerry's in Scotland. It's element-active.co.uk is the website. And it's a very good initiative that she works on for that. And I think it'll do cycling and other activities as well there. Going back to your point just now about people not thinking they were innovators at the time, that's what made me put the quote from Condoleezza Rice into the introduction to the book, who's no way a sports person, but a politician from America. And her quote somewhere I found was, "People who end up as first don't actually set out to be first, they set out to do something they love." And that's kind of what a lot of the people, the message that I was getting about how they became involved. It was just, I'd love to do this, I'm going to do this.
Yes.
That's a really strong, positive element of change, really, isn't it?
Yeah. So they love doing it, I'm just going to do it. And now, oh, other people might like it, let's bring them along too. Yeah. Yeah. So I really like the way the book is set out. So you've got the pioneers right at the start. You've got like Jean Dawes doing her first women's Bob Graham in 1977. And then you get another wave, don't you, of runners like Angela Mudge and Hélène Diamantidis. And they are not necessarily the pioneers, but they are just... at a time when not many women do the sport, they are excelling and competing and loving doing the sport. So what was it like interviewing those guys? Because, I mean, they were still competing till fairly recently, weren't they?
Absolutely. Angela Mudge, Wendy Dodds.
Wendy.
Both still active, I believe. Helen and I had already interviewed for one of the other books, and I went back to her just to get more thoughts. And she was... very much a driven person. You know that she the first Dragon's Back, I think she won it with Martin Stone.
She won it joint with Martin Stone in
to her that was just normal activity that she would do. It happened to be Martin who was the person she was going to do it with. You know, it could have been anybody. It could have been a woman, it could have been a man, it could have been anybody, and it was just that worked for her. And it wasn't, she made a comment somewhere about she didn't really care about people thinking about her being a female or whatever it might be. It was just she was an athlete. That's a kind of a perspective that some people have and some people don't. But yeah, it was very interesting to talk to her. Angela, I had a phone exchange with, I think it was. But yeah, they've got such a record because they are people who were on the fringe of the early days and are still running now. And that's fantastic. You know, the fact that veteran competition is now strong in the championships and there's rewards and things for different age categories is partly because of those people doing it and wanting to be rewarded. Yeah.
So. And then you've got a section on women actually coming first in things. So can you just talk a little bit about that? Because that sounds very exciting.
Well, the thing is, I chose to stop my progress at the 2001, the foot and mouth year. So I wasn't going to be commenting on stuff that Jasmine had done and things like that. But yeah, there was Carol, what's the surname now?
Carol Morgan?
All
I can think of.
How embarrassing, I've forgotten the name.
There were so many names. I'll have a look in
Sarah Rowell won an off-road...
Carol Hayes.
That's it, Carol Hayes.
I couldn't remember either.
won a race where, unfortunately for the guy who was in the lead, went off course. But at the end of the day, she'd still beat everyone at that race. And that's fantastic. And there's records for highest positions in races. Angela Mudge, I think, has got the highest position ever in the Three Peaks race of a female in the wide field. And they're just amazing performances and should be acknowledged and recognised as that level of performance. But yeah, definitely.
Yeah. And I think it is good that you've stopped it at 2001, because the book is big enough with just the history. And then I'm just wondering, what is the future for you, Steve? Are you thinking of doing a 2000s onward book? Because it would be so lovely to see like a compilation, like in history for like people like Sabrina Virgie, Jasmine Paris, Nikki Spinks, Beth Pascal, and then a bit more coming through from like Wendy's still doing stuff, isn't she? Sarah Rolls obviously still like in her managerial positions, and what's Angela up to now? Just so many amazing women, and like I don't know if you'd want to keep it to the UK, but Tony Reeves has just also added that Lucy Bartholomew and Emily Forsberg are also both incredible. There's so many incredible female athletes. Maybe you could just keep it to the UK, but there are just another book with a celebration of all their achievements, like up to maybe, I don't know, 2025 or something. Like, would that be something you'd be interested in doing? Did you enjoy it that much that you want to write some more womanly books? Or maybe there's like, you know how you've done like rivalries and records from the men's point of view, maybe there's a rival, really good women's rivalry that you've heard about now, or a really good record that you want to just focus in on for the women. What's next?
Well, my real hope is that some of those people will choose to write their own biographies. I feel that Jasmine should do, but her career is so young at the moment that there's much more to come from her.
Yeah. Nikki, she's not as young as
Jasmine,
but
still got much to do.
Yeah.
And obviously Sabrina's written about the Wainwrights, which is brilliant. And I just think, I wish more females would come forward and write about their involvement in the sport.
Yeah, but they don't have time. So that's
starting to happen in the women's football side because of the profile that women's football has got now, which is brilliant, you know. So I would like to do that, but I actually feel it should be done by the people involved. Emily has written at least one book, Emily Forsberg. So that's really good, and I've read that, and it's a really good read. But yeah, there should be more people writing their own stuff. I can tell you that I'm working on another book at the moment.
Oh, can you tell us what it's about, or give us any hints at all?
I think I can, because it's I've got even more narrow than anything else before. I'm writing about one single race.
Wow.
I'm writing a history of the Three Peaks race.
So that will be like women and men?
Yes, absolutely, yeah. So the other day I went to interview Victoria Wilkinson and Sarah Rowell together, and that was fantastic. And I'm waiting to do Sarah McCormack, who's actually in Austria in the World Champs at the moment. So I'm working through that, and I've got some really good interviews from some of them from the Voices book actually refer to their experiences, so I'm augmenting that. And it's going to be a bit like the subtitle of It's a Hill, Get Over It was History and Characters, and it's going to be the Three Peaks race, it's history and characters.
Amazing.
Because, you know, it goes back to the 1950s, and it was, you know, there were six people in the first race, and it's built up, so they have to close the doors on an entry of 900 now. And I find it interesting that it's a crossover race to marathoners, cross-country runners,
yeah,
and everything else, you know.
It's called the Marathon in the Mountains, isn't it? They bill it as that.
Yeah, it is, but the interesting thing is I could name several marathon runners who thought they could just go and win the Three Peaks, and they didn't have the fell background and skills to deal with the ups and downs on the Three Peaks.
Yeah.
Ron Hill, for instance, at his peak, had a go several times and failed to win the Three Peaks. Yet he was virtually unbeatable at the marathon and won some quite short fell races. So, you know, there's a Joss, bless him, our man Joss Naylor, 10 times he did the Three Peaks. He used to win the mountain trial and everything. It was, as Billy Bland said to me, who also failed to win it, there's too much running in it.
Oh, yeah.
And that's like a counterintuitive argument for someone, really, but there's quite a lot of flat, obviously. So I've had some really interesting comments from the people I've interviewed, you know, Jethro Lennox and Tom Owens and Jeff Norm and all the people. And so that's what I'm working on. I'm hoping that I'll get it out for next year's Three Peaks event, which is in April next year. So
fantastic. Yeah. Oh, well, that sounds like a great book. I'm wishing you all the best with that one. It's just great to have this book and just have that written history of all these amazing women. And I've not heard of a lot of them before. It's lovely to be able to share their story and for you to have broadcast their voice louder. So I just want to say thank you, Steve, for writing such an important book. I do hope to see many more books about female foul runners and records and rivalries in the future, right, whether it's from you or anyone else. Because if they don't have time, then you may as well just crack, you know.
Can I give a plug to the fact that this is the first one that's actually had an audio version?
Have you done the audio to it?
Sorry?
Have you done the audio to it?
No. I was dreading that they'd ask me. But it's done by a professional reader. It's quite interesting hearing your own words read by someone. It's very good and very enthusiastic, and it comes across very well. It's just a kind of appropriate, the
Definitely.
Book about voices.
Yeah.
It's the first time it's been an audio book. Oh. I should be doing a...
Is it a woman then who's audition. Doing the... Is it a woman's voice then?
Yeah. In fact, if you want a token for an audio version of the book to use as a prize, I can supply that to you.
Yeah, that would be great. I'll just put that on my to-do list. Cool. Steve Book Prize. And it's really appropriate, I think, that all your books get put onto audiobooks because people want to listen to that kind of stuff while they're out on a long run, don't they? So it's
Inspiration on the go.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that's brilliant. If you can bring all of them out as audiobooks, that would help me as well because I barely get time to sit down and read a book.
can I give a finishing quote?
If there's anything we haven't covered yet, then just crack on, say it.
It's actually the other one that's at the beginning of the book by a non-athlete. So this is Sarah Wiegman, who's the manager of the English women's national football team. Her quote is, "We should always remember the ones who went before as they made a path for us." And I think that kind of sums up what the book is about to me. And that's just a nice thought, that don't forget the people who paved the way.
Yeah.
It's the old idea of standing on the shoulders of giants. That's rather nice summary of how I feel about it.
Yeah, well, this book is definitely remembering those who've come before. So you're a part of that pavement now, Steve, for sure. You're a part of making sure you've weeded it all and you've galvanized it, so it's super strong now. So that's fantastic. I just want to read out before we leave a couple of things from some live comments.
Yep.
From people who have just a couple of them who have had a really nice time listening to you today, Steve. Today says, thanks very much, great interview. And Tony Reeves says, thanks, Steve, really interesting point of view and great interview as well. And Hannah Basley's had a great time watching as well. She is out with a dog in the glorious Peak District watching right now, so that's great. and George Broderick as well. He just became a member and of the YouTube channel because of this broadcast. So thank you very much, Steve. It's been great chatting to you today, Steve, and I wish you all the best for your next book.
Thank you very much. It's great to talk to you. Thank you.